So for those of you who don't know, my name's Rob Myers. Because there's no time in the schedule for introductory remarks, so, well, there is, right? But I'm late. But I'll try and keep it short. The first announcement was that for people who were at the Asymptotic Safety Conference, there are new packets if you're staying or requested to stay for this workshop. And oh, there they are being held up. Another announcement was that if you have any questions, the real person to ask is Holly Hatch, who's standing at the back. She'll be in room 206. But I also wanted to take this opportunity that Holly's really the powerhouse here behind the conference program. So she's done an awful lot of work both for this workshop and for the previous meeting. And so I'd like to take the opportunity of having her in the room to thank her for all of her efforts. And so now Holly can go home.
Okay.
We also have a number of organizers. And like with any organizing committee, there's one person that really does most of the work. And so that would happen to be Dario again. So I'd also like to thank Dario for all of his efforts in bringing this together. And so with no further ado, then I'll turn it over to Petter.
Thank you. It's indeed a great pleasure for me to be here. And I want to second what Rob just said. And I want to thank the organizers, the real organizers, Rob and Dario. And Holly's gone, but she's done a tremendous job helping this grand gathering to be put together in an efficient way. So I want to thank also the organizers of the Asymptotic Safety Workshop for inviting me to address both of the audiences. And the topic of my talk is quantum gravity with anisotropic scaling, which is kind of related to both audiences simultaneously. So let me start with just mentioning a few references. This is mostly based on five papers that I've published in the last year or so. The fifth one is with my student Charles, who is here in the audience, and he's going to talk about some of the aspects of our work together on Tuesday. There's also some follow-up work which will appear shortly, both with Charles and with other students at Berkeley, Kevin Grossbender. I'm also working with Senke Shu at Harvard on something which I'll mention as we go along. I gave a talk at the Strings Conference in Rome in June, and on this same transparency, I had a huge list of names of people who have written follow-up papers, and I've kind of given up on listing all the names. Many of the people who work on this fascinating topic are here in the audience, and I thank you all for being here, but I won't list any names explicitly. So I would like to start, because I'm still addressing both audiences, those people who worked on asymptotic safety over the last number of decades, and also people who started thinking about anisotropic scaling. What is the big picture? And to me, the big picture is kind of like this old map of California, which is a map by a Dutch cartographer from the 17th century. So these new ideas of combining anisotropic scaling and condensed matter ideology with gravity is kind of like landing on a new continent. You see that something fascinating is going on, you're discovering something new. Maybe we don't have all the details right yet, like in this map. California is not particularly, or not yet, island. But maybe this is a good approximation to where we are in this land of anisotropic scaling in quantum gravity. We have seen something really interesting. All the details haven't been put in place yet, but it's still fascinating to keep discovering this this new land. So technically, the central idea, as I already mentioned, is to combine gravity with concepts that come from condensed matter physics. One of the motivations might be we haven't quite succeeded yet in formulating a complete satisfactory picture of quantum gravity, and as a result, we shouldn't tie our hands artificially by limiting our techniques. In particular, we shouldn't ignore the the enormous amount of data and interesting ideas that people work also on quantum physics, but in the context of fundamental matter physics, have come up with over the last 40 years or so. And in particular, in quantum matter, of course, there is no need to insist on Lorentz invariance. And if you parameterize your space and time by some coordinates, typically what is very relevant for quantum matter systems are situations where time and space scale in a different way. Of course, the techniques that they use to describe the physical phenomena are very close to our hearts in high energy physics. They use local quantum field theory, they use randomization group ideology. The techniques are really the same. It just happens that they impose the same macroscopic symmetries as we do in high energy physics. In particular, the amount of anisotropy between the scaling of space and time is characterized in the RG sense by a new critical exponent, typically referred to as Z, known as the dynamical critical exponent. If you want to learn more about quantum field theories in these types of scalings, then you can either go to any random quantum matter theory book, or you can, and that would be my favorite scenario, you can look at John's book on quantum field theory, which is one of my favorite quantum field theory books, where he actually does calculate these quantities, the dynamical critical exponent, in some of the later chapters of the book. So this possibility of anisotropic scaling in the context of dynamical phenomena is not quite alien to high energy physics. It just hasn't been used too often. So in quantum matter, in particular, if you are curious what the values of Z are that you can encounter, you can get, as you might naively expect, a bunch of integers. Perhaps Z is equal to 1. That would be the case when you insist on Lorentz invariance that automatically picks out this particular value of the critical exponent. In a Galilean invariant system, it might be natural to expect that Z is equal to 2 exactly. But there are systems which exhibit all kinds of other fractional values of Z. For example, the famous KPZ surface growth problem in 1 plus 1 dimensions leads to an exact value of Z equal to 3 halves. So even more exotic values of Z, not those that correspond to Gaussian fixed points, are possible and, in fact, experimentally verifiable in quantum matter physics. And a particular example of situations where this type of anisotropic scaling comes up is in the context of promoting a static critical system in statistical mechanics to a dynamical one. And it's well known that a given static universality class of a critical behavior of a system, which is of course equivalently described by Euclidean quantum field theory, actually falls into several different or splits into several different universality classes once you take into account the possibility of dynamical scaling on the time dimension. So the study of these dynamical critical phenomena in particular has used this ideology of allowing Z to be a priori unconstrained and studied what kind of possibilities of the dynamical behavior may be studied in quantum field theory. So all this technology is out there, and why should we artificially limit ourselves in the study of quantum gravity in situations which are, by definition, Lorentz invariant, in the sense at least of the isotropic scaling? So more precisely, the ideas of an isotropic gravity, I think they are so closely related to the idea of asymptotic safety that in some sense they fall into the same category of models. The main distinction is, on both sides of the issue, both the previous workshop and the upcoming workshop, we are all looking for ubiquities in quantum gravity. And of course, in the case of asymptotic safety, you insist on a relativistic description. In other words, you postulate isotropic scaling as a part of the definition of what you're looking for. And as a result, you are obviously looking for a non-trivial fixed point. And we've heard many very fascinating talks on the amount of progress that people have made over the last 30 years from this idea. In contrast, in the Lipschitz-type gravity, the proposal is that it might be actually valuable to abandon the idea of Lorentz invariance at short distances and look for a non-relativistic gravitational fixed point, a UV fixed point, which would, compared to the asymptotic safety program, it might actually end up having the advantage of being a Gaussian fixed point. We know that in statistical mechanics or in quantum field theory, it's much more practical if you are lucky enough so that your degrees of freedom are described in terms of Gaussian fixed points. You are in business because you can calculate. You can push the calculation quite far. It's much more difficult if your fixed point is far away from being a Gaussian fixed point. And that, it seems to me that in this static safety program, it is very unlikely that the natural fixed points that people have been finding evidence for would end up being weakly coupled. So it's not clear to me if there are any weakly coupled variables, what those would be near that natural fixed point. So in contrast, in the Lipschitz type gravity, we say, let's look for a Gaussian fixed point, and the price that you have to pay for being able to calculate perturbation theory near a Gaussian fixed point is that you put in by hand, or relax the condition of isotropy, more precisely, you put in the possibility of an isotropy between space and time. And as I will mention later on in this talk, there are even, of course, more exotic options where you can even introduce an additional anisotropy between various spatial dimensions. And that might be a very interesting twist to the story, as we'll also see in a few minutes. So the main point is, and this is central to the old idea of Lipschitz type gravity. If you want to apply a particular, perhaps, to gravity in, as we know it in 3 plus 1 physical dimensions, the point is that this anisotropy is put in by hand at short distances, just like in any, let's say, condensed matter nanoelectric system. You might start with degrees of freedom which are completely oblivious to Lorentz invariance. In this sense, I want to correct some of the statements that appear in the literature. In these types of models, I wouldn't say that Lorentz invariance has been broken. Lorentz invariance has never been there as a fundamental symmetry at short scales. It might appear as an emergent symmetry at long distances. So that's the whole idea of Lipschitz-type scalings. If you start with a model, and I'll show you examples, non-gravitational examples in some detail because they're very illuminating. You start with a theory with an isotropic Lipschitz-type scaling at short distances. So your UV fixed point might have some non-trivial value of z greater than 1. Typically, you look at the critical surface of that fixed point, and you see how many relevant deformations you have in your theory. You can flow under the influence of these relevant deformations. And generically, what happens, and this is really generic in the sense of RG, there is no fine-tuning involved, you generically flow to systems with z equal to 1. And that's, of course, what we want in the infrared. We want to be comparing to relativistic systems. Of course, as I said, Lorentz invariance implies, by definition, that you have to have z equal to 1. But of course, in the opposite direction, it doesn't work. There are many systems which would have z equal to 1, but would not be Lorentz invariant. But at least getting the correct value of the dynamical exponent in the infrared is generic in these types of systems. There are examples of this in condensed matter where, of course, everybody is familiar with simple models such as a 1 plus 1 dimensional Fermi liquid, where, of course, you generically near the Fermi surface at low energies, that's where the low energy excitations reside, you discover an emergent low energy dispersion relation, which is relativistic, and of course leads to z equal to 1. There are more sophisticated examples or situations typically with gapless modes that are explained in terms of Boltzmann degrees of freedom, would again have a sector where the scaling is such that it leads to an emergent relativistic symmetry. I also want to mention another possible context in which Lipschitz-type gravities with an isotropic scaling with values of z higher than 1 might appear. There's a work in progress. We are finishing a paper with Senkev Shu, who is a junior fellow at Harvard in the condensed matter group. And the Lipschitz-type gravity in that context appears in a completely different setting. Instead of describing the short distance behavior at hypothetical UV fixed point, it actually comes out to be the infrared fixed point in a lattice system where you put a bunch of Bose degrees of freedom on a rigid lattice. This is not fluctuating lattices with summations over triangulations. A conventional three-dimensional rigid lattice. And this is a generalization of some simpler models which showed up in the past where there were various dimer models in which you can have non-gauge degrees of freedom on short scales on the lattice, and they give you an emergent gauge symmetry. So we were at least able to see in this context of the Bose liquid on a lattice that either the z equal to 2 or z equal to 3, depending on your choice of the Hamiltonian on the lattice, Lipschitz gravities in 3 plus 1 dimensions emerge dynamically as emergent gravitational systems. The catch here is that it is really the true fixed point, the Gaussian fixed point that shows up. You cannot turn on interactions and say that somehow the theory becomes interacting at long distances. It is described by this free field Gaussian limit of the Lipschitz type gravity.
Excuse me, by gravity here, do you just mean there's a spatial dynamical metric?
There's a spatial dynamical metric, and the gauge symmetries are basically linear as diffeomorphisms.
Spatial diffeomorphisms?
Time-dependent, time and space-dependent spatial diffeomorphisms, plus it's precisely the Lipschitz-type model that I've been talking about in a few minutes at the linearized level. So just the infrared fixed point, free field fixed point shows up, not an interacting theory of gravity, in case you were wondering whether this solves the problem of constructing quantum gravity from a lattice. It doesn't. Perhaps the catch here is that, of course, the theory is defined on a rigid lattice, and in order to allow non-trivial interactions among the gravitons that show up in the infrared here, you would probably have to allow the lattice to fluctuate and become very hot. Okay, so why would we be interested in general? I think this audience is very sympathetic to the idea that string theory is perhaps a beautiful theory of quantum gravity, but in some sense, a framework which is too large, and we are all looking for a simpler framework which would use the conventional old-fashioned techniques of quantum field theory without invoking some new extra freedom. If that's possible, just like it is possible for QCD, then we don't need the technology of string theory necessarily, even though it might still be very useful, just like in the case of QCD and its supersymmetric cousins, to embed such a self-contained theory into a bigger framework of string theory. Trying to engineer these types of gravitational models from string theory is a very worthy goal. I don't really have that much to report. Perhaps Charles might mention some preliminary results in his talk on Tuesday. So let's take string theory as an example of a mathematically successful quantum theory of gravity, and let's see what kind of lessons we've learned. In the 20th century, of course, you can characterize a lot of the developments in the area of quantum gravity as a struggle or a fight between quantum mechanics and the symmetries of general relativity. And it was always kind of interesting to see whether quantum mechanics is more fundamental or GR is more fundamental, or none of them are fundamental. They can be combined together in some novel framework. The main lesson from string theory is that in that framework, at least, quantum mechanics seems to have won, absolutely. We haven't touched the rules of quantum mechanics one bit. Quantum mechanics stays, general relativity and its symmetries get modified. In particular, if I think of Lorentz symmetry as the symmetry of a Minkowski spacetime, there are many indications that in string theory, we can easily generate space, at least, if not the entire spacetime, as an emergent quantity, perhaps from some matrix values of freedom, some other dual variables. It is, on the other hand, very difficult to make time emergent. At least I don't know how to do it. There are preliminary results again, but it's more or less established that space can be treated as an emergent property. I would find it philosophically difficult to believe that if, in the fundamental theory of gravity, such as string theory, space-time is emergent, or at least space is emergent, how can I anticipate Lorentz symmetry to be fundamental in the absence of the fundamental space-time? So it seems reasonable not to put in Lorentz invariant by hand, not to tie our hands too much, and allow for a more generic description of fluctuating geometries in the language of quantum field theory. There's another motivation, which is not often mentioned in this context, but as you remember, introducing the non-trivial dynamical critical exponent was particularly useful for taking static universality classes and taking them out of equilibrium, studying non-trivial time evolution in critical systems. And it's been my philosophical prejudice for a long time now that in string theory, and in particular in our description of quantum gravity within string theory, we haven't been particularly successful describing time-dependent phenomena, cosmology, and so on. And we've been very successful describing static phenomena. Why is that? Perhaps it is because we haven't properly developed this conceptual step that takes us from static string theory, which is what we are good at now, to time-dependent, non-equilibrium version of string theory. So these attempts to build in some non-trivial timescaling in the context of quantum gravity, these attempts are perhaps steps towards developing some kind of a non-equilibrium version of string theory. And of course, another motivation that one might have for abandoning the unity of space and time in quantum gravity is the notorious problem of time. Whenever you try to quantize gravity from first principles, you are struggling with this issue in one way or another. I won't spend any time describing this issue to you, but there are several very interesting review papers and even books in principle on this topic. So this has been a notoriously difficult issue. How do you resolve the fact that time appears on a very different footing in quantum mechanics compared to the role it plays in the conventional description of general relativity in terms of space-time, the dimorphism invariance. So again, abandoning the unity of space and time, putting time on a separate special footing might be a reasonable starting point if you believe that quantum mechanics is somehow more fundamental, and that's the lesson that we learned from string theory. Of course, the convincing example where putting time on a different footing from space has really produced spectacular new results is precisely the quantum dynamical triangulations approach to quantum gravity that Jan and Renate referred to in their talks. So this is another point of kind of piece in the puzzle that perhaps putting time on a separate footing from space might be a very useful thing to do if you want to end up with a consistent, mathematically consistent theory of quantum gravity. So this is a very important transparency for me because I think developing a consistent, mathematically consistent theory of quantum gravity with an isotropic scaling has at least five different possible applications. And so far, most of the focus of many of the follow-up papers has been on applying this anisotropic scaling idea to describe perhaps a system which in the infrared mimics as closely as possible our own universe, perhaps reproduces in some limit the precise results of conventional general relativity at long distances. To me, that's only one of the many possible applications. It is, of course, the application that historically generated all this interest in quantum gravity. Why do we care about quantum gravity? Is it only because of the presence of gravity in our own universe? And until maybe 20 years ago, the answer would be, yes, this is the only reason why we care. But with the onset of ADS-CFT correspondence and string theory, at least two additional applications have become very important. In particular, string theory is so successful, in my opinion, and I'll return to this point in a few minutes. It's so successful because it actually does represent a quantum field theory quantization of gravity, a quantum gravity system. It's a gravity system on the worksheet of the string, where essentially what you do is you quantize gravity with matter. You can do it in two dimensions because that's, in many ways, as you all know, the critical dimension for quantum gravity. And that's one of the reasons why string theory is so powerful. It takes quantum gravity seriously, not in space-time at first, but on the worksheet of the string. So if we develop some new theories of gravity in other dimensions, for which the critical dimension is not two, but perhaps three, maybe you can think of putting them on wall volumes or frames of other dimensions. And again, that would be a different type of applications compared to point number one. Point number three might be the most practical one. If you develop a consistent theory of gravitational degrees of freedom in any number of dimensions with any kind of scaling, you don't even have to reproduce anything relativistic, you might consider using this mathematically consistent gravity model as a dual description of some new class of conformal field theories. In some sense, this is actually the point where my program started, because we were interested in developing some language for describing gravity rules for non-relativistic CFTs. And once you allow the boundary CFT to be non-relativistic with all kinds of exotic values of the dynamical exponent, why would you insist that your gravity theory in the bulk has to be relativistic? Perhaps there are anisotropic versions of gravity in the bulk which are relevant for describing the bigger class of non-relativistic CFTs. So this application has nothing to do with the gravity in our universe as we know it. Nevertheless, it could be a very powerful way of using the technology of quantum gravity for understanding quantum matter systems at strong coupling. Point number four is that there might be mathematical applications. I'll mention this more in one transparency later. And also, the fifth application, in some previous talk, I was only really listing four applications. This fifth application was somewhat unexpected. This was something that came up in our work with Charles, and Charles will report on this in detail in his talk on Tuesday. Some of the concepts that we develop in the context of anisotropic scaling actually surprisingly become relevant also for conventional GR. So you can say, even if you don't buy the idea of anisotropic scaling, you really insist that your gravity be nice and relativistic in the bulk, there are still situations such as the proposed gravity rules for non-relativistic CFTs where your space-time is at least asymptotically anisotropic. There's some natural scaling where some particular value of z not equal to 1 is picked out near the boundary. And people had notoriously difficulties performing the holographic renormalization in spacetimes with this type of asymptotics. Because if you apply the conventional Penrose definition of 1, infinity to these spacetimes, you get nonsense from the point of view of what you expect based on holography. So we actually were able to reconcile this issue using techniques, mathematical concepts that came from anisotropic gravity models. We can provide a definition of conformal infinity for these anisotropic asymptotic spacetimes, which makes sense and allows you to do holography as in conventional ADS CFT correspondence. So that's a class of applications which is unexpected, and it's valid even if you don't particularly show interest in making the bulk theory anisotropic. The bulk gravity model here is conventional GR with perhaps some relativistic matter. All right, so very quickly, what makes string theory special? I don't want to spend too much time on string theory, but it does kind of motivate why you look for anisotropic scaling. It's a coincidence of several different facts that makes two-dimensional worksheets special. One of those facts is that if you look at the action of the relativistic scalar field, of course, it's a famous result that phi, the field itself, is of this particular dimension if you are in the Euclidean dimensions. And as a result, phi is dimensionalized precisely in two Euclidean dimensions. The theory is at its low critical dimension when the dimension is two. And that's very important because, of course, once your field phi is dimensionless, you can formally put in an infinite collection of classically dimensionless coupling constants. So the theory is of a very unique class of theory. It belongs to a very unique class of theories, namely those that have classically an infinite number of marginal couplings. Then you calculate the beta function to see how many of these couplings survive as marginal, let's say at one loop, and you find out, of course, as was famously derived first by Dan Friedan when he was a student at Berkeley, that Einstein's equations for the target manifold follow from the beta function equations. It's probably the most concise and beautiful way of deriving Einstein's equations out of the quantum field theory. And it has to do precisely with the fact that phi is at its low critical dimension in two Euclidean dimensions. Another coincidence is that, as you all know, the Newton constant is formally dimensionalized precisely in two dimensions. So again, gravity would be, in this formal sense, at its critical dimension in two dimensions. That's the reason why you can just perturbatively quantize it by conventional methods to invent something very exotic. And the system of coupled fields, gravity in two dimensions makes perfect sense and defines string theory. So let me review very quickly an example of a scalar field theory which has an isotropic scaling for various reasons. In particular, this is a very good example which exhibits many features which we can then try to repeat in the gravitational context. So now I'm keeping the notation where d is the number of Euclidean dimensions. Now I'm treating them as spatial dimensions. I'm adding the time dimension, and throughout the rest I'll be using consistently the non-relativistic notation where the dot is the time derivative. The Laplace operator here is the spatial Laplace operator on the scalar field. This is the first example, the simplest example of a Lipschitz type quantum field theory, which is, of course, non-relativistic in the sense that in order to make this term and that term of the same dimension, clearly this is a system with z equal to 2. So you have to scale time as if it were worth two spatial dimensions under the RG scaling. And this is your definition of the RG Gaussian fixed point with this type of anisotropic scaling. It is closely related to this model, this quantum field theory, is closely related to the quantum field theory on the previous transparency. And that's essentially because this term here, if you think about it, is precisely the square of the equational motion of the lower dimensional system. This is the condition of so-called detailed balance that plays an important role in stochastic quantization and in dynamical critical phenomena. I don't want to get into the details. We can perhaps discuss what extent detailed balance is a useful mathematical trick or whether it is a physical concept in this gravity context during the conference. But for now, let me just state that because term here is the square of the equational motion of the lower dimensional system, we can determine an exact ground state wave function for this theory in the d plus one dimensions. And it's essentially given by the density of the path integral of the Euclidean theory in one lower dimension. But more importantly, the critical dimension of the field phi has shifted. It is now in its lower critical dimension when the spatial number of dimensions is 2. So 2 plus 1 is the critical dimension here, where you expect a similar richness of the beta functions as in relativistic sigma models in two relativistic dimensions. And I wanted to mention the question of calculating the beta functions. This theory is very interesting because it actually exhibits something we want to then mimic in the gravity setting. In particular, you can ask, if this is my Gaussian newly fixed point, what is the dimension of the critical surface? How many relevant deformations can I turn on? And you can turn on two relevant deformations here, at least if I'm mostly just, let's consider the Gaussian theories first, and we can even turn on self-interactions and study dimensions of various self-interaction terms. Of course, this can be analyzed as usual in the context of the full renormalization group ideology, where you would say, let me postulate my symmetries, my fields, and then let me write down the entire infinite collection of operators of growing dimension around this Gaussian fixed point. But since these theories are all the theories that I'll be talking about are power counting renormalizable in the interesting dimensions, I'll be ignoring all the irrelevant terms in the action. But they're there. If you want to run the whole thing, in principle, you can. And we won't be calculating any beta functions anyway. So let's simplify things and keep only the marginal and relevant terms in the action. So the relevant terms are of two kinds. This would be the conventional mass term in the relativistic setting. But there's also this term here, which is essentially, if you are stuck in the relativistic way of thinking, this is the missing part of the relativistic kinetic term. In other words, if mu squared is real, and this sign is negative, the first term with the dot squared and this term will combine together in the infrared to form a relativistic kinetic term. In other words, what happens, as you see here, and these are the most relevant terms you can turn on, they accidentally restore the value of z equal to 1, the theory flows to, and in this case, not just a z equal to 1 model, but of course, for a single scalar, you get an exactly relativistic theory in the infrared. So it's something that you would want to obtain in gravity as well, although in gravity it's easier to get z equal to 1. It's not so clear whether one can reproduce the full Lorentz invariant theory of gravity in the infrared. And I also want to point out that the role played by this coupling constant mu, if you look at the natural space-time coordinates in which you want to describe the physics at long distances here, they're not the original non-relativistic coordinates t and x. After all, t and x scale a different way. They have a different scaling dimension. What you want to do in the infrared, in order to capture the natural scaling of z equal to 1, you want to absorb one part of mu into your rescaling of time. So you define the infrared notion of a time coordinate, x0, as mu times t, and that's the natural coordinate in which you want to measure the physics of the system if you are a low energy observer who believes that the theory is Lorentz invariant. So, in other words, the role of the speed of light, which is emergent here from the relevant deformation, the role of the speed of light is played by the relevant coupling constant near the UV fixed point, and we'll see that exactly the same story repeats itself for gravity. Now, this is perhaps a very important transparency, not because it just illustrates the notion of Lipschitz theories as they showed up originally in quantum matter in 1941 as descriptions of tricritical points, but also because there is so much similarity between this phase diagram and the phase diagram that we saw in Jahn's talk, and it was also mentioned in Renato's talk. So the idea here is, let me first explain it for the scalar, and then we can speculate on the similarities to the dynamical triangulation approach. So the Lipschitz field theory, as I described it by the UV fixed point that's equal to 2, resides here at the tricritical point. This is how Lipschitz discovered it at first. He said, we know that we can get tricritical or multicritical behaviors by tuning coefficients in the potential of some field theory, but why stop there? Why not tune also some coefficients of containing spatial derivatives along some number of spatial dimensions? And you can easily see how that immediately grows into a pattern where you can separate various groups of dimensions into groups with different types of scaling. So there's an infinite hierarchy of models you can construct. The simplest one, again, where I'm only allowing an anisotropy between space and time, and I have only one scalar here, phi, is interesting because once you do that, and in order to do what I'm about to do, it's important to pay attention to these two coefficients here. These two scales are the two parameters that you tune in order to get to the tricritical point. So as you tune them, you end up with a tricritical point, but if you are at the tricritical point, you can access three different phases. After all, it's a tricritical point. So you can access the usual two phases of the scalar field in the relativistic context, where phi either does or does not have a non-trivial constant f in space-time. And of course, this is a conventional second-order phase transition line between them. But once you start tuning the spatial part of the relativistic kinetic term, the coefficient that I called mu, I believe, in the previous transparency, you can end up with the wrong sign of mu. If mu has the wrong sign here, then you are in a situation which is very similar to the Higgs space. Again, you have to identify the correct ground state. And it's not going to be the naive phi equal to 0, just like in the Higgs case. But now, it's not even going to be a constant. Oops, sorry, I'm in the wrong direction here. It's not going to be a homogeneous phase. It's going to be a spatially modulated phase. So as you go in the wrong direction with that mu squared coefficient, you access a phase where phi involves a spatially dependent vacuum expectation value. So these three phases typically are very relevant to systems with Lipschitz type behaviors, and it's kind of tempting to really conjecture that the type of tricritical point that Jahn and company obtained in the case of causal dynamical triangulations, as we saw in the talk this morning, that this tricritical point does exhibit an isotropic scaling. I believe Jahn will have a lot more to say about that later this afternoon. And it's even tempting to say perhaps those three phases should somehow be in one-to-one correspondence with the typical three phases that you end up with on three different sides of the tricritical point. I should say that this line here is typically first order. So again, there are many similarities with the phase diagram we saw this morning. So as I said, this ideology can be generalized where you say, maybe I allow for an additional spatial anisotropy. I group all space-time coordinates into various groups with very different types of scaling, and I have an infinite hierarchy of models in principle. I'm just mentioning it for future reference. Now, finally, we come to the construction of the same type of behavior for gravity. And we can just start by mimicking the steps that led to the Lipschitz scalar field theory. So we want to start with some kinetic term for a spatial metric. So Gij, again, is just the spatial components of the metric. I don't have collapse and shift variables here yet. They'll come in a little later. And I write down the most naive kinetic term. I, of course, want to preserve spatial diffeomorphism invariance. It's a gauge symmetry, so I have to use a Dewitt metric of some sort to contract the indices here. And in this case here, the class of Dewitt metrics with respect to diffeomorphism invariance in space is containing this extra coupling constant little lambda. which of course is a dimensionless coupling, and in principle you expect it to run, so we shouldn't constrain it to have any particular value. Now, if I wanted to simplify my life, and instead of writing down the most generic Lagrangian that respects some form of anisotropic scaling, I may want to impose the additional condition of the detailed balance. Namely, I insist that the spatial part of the action, what I call SV, V standing for the potential, I'm again using the strictly non-logistic terminology here, so this is the kinetic term, and whatever else depends on spatial derivatives only is the potential term. I can postulate that the potential term is the square of the variation of a lower dimensional action with respect to the spatial metric. Why do I do that? Well, there are two reasons. One of them is that it might be a useful trick that cuts down on the number of independent couplings, because if it is true in gravity context, just as in, let's say, Yang-Mills, that if you do stochastic quantization, which is essentially the recruited version of this, you don't introduce new additional coupling constants besides the renormalization between time and space. You get essentially the same couplings that were already contained in the simpler Euclidean signature theory in one lower dimension. Then we can calculate beta functions more efficiently instead of allowing for a generic set of terms in the action which all respect the same underlying gauging values.
So why doesn't the Ritt metric have curvature in it?
Because I assign scaling dimension zero to the metric, and I'm looking for terms of the lowest dimension. There would, of course, be corrections of higher dimension. I'm implicitly suppressing all the higher dimensional operators besides marginal. All right, so this first attempt is an interesting step in some direction, but it doesn't really have interesting enough gauge symmetries because it's only invariant under time-independent spatial diffeomorphisms. That doesn't sound too exciting. So in order to coherentize and allow at least for the time dependence in this spatial reformatization, you can introduce ADM-like variables, collapse and shift functions, and replace, it turns out if you replace the derivative with the extrinsic curvature of constant time slices like so, and replace the square root of g by n times the square root of g, then the same action that we had on the previous transparency gets coherentized, and it becomes invariant under all symmetries that preserve a preferred foliation of spacetime by constant time slices. I should say, the structure of the foliation is oblivious to the metric. In differential geometry, people define foliated manifolds first, and then you can put a metric on top of the manifold. It's not different in any metric sense. It's a part of the differential structure of the manifold. Now, in what I would call the minimal realization or the minimal model of Lipschitz-type gravity, N, which is in some sense the gauge symmetry associated with the time reparametrizations of time, is restricted to be a function of only time. I'll comment on this later, and we'll probably discuss this a lot during the conference, but this is the minimal setting. In some sense, the shift functions are like gauge fields associated with spatial diffeomorphisms, so they are allowed accordingly to depend on both time and space, because these are the gauge symmetries. But N, which is essentially a gauge symmetry, gauge field associated with the time reparametrizations, is only a function of time. As a result, this model, the minimal model, will have one additional polarization of the graviton, the scalar polarization, at least naively, if you expand your flat space solution. So the first example might be a model where we do satisfy the detailed balance condition with respect to the Einstein-Hilbert action. This is going to be a theory which is equal to 2. And so this is, again, the kinetic term which contains this lambda parameter. And the potential term becomes the square of Einstein's equations. What's here in yellow is the marginal terms. I haven't turned on relevant deformations yet. I'm going to do that very shortly. And if you keep only these terms, then of course you can easily read out the dimension of this object, which kind of plays the role similar to the Newton constant, although it is not a physical Newton constant, of course. The dimension is 2 minus b. So again, the critical dimension for this system, where this coupling constant is dimensionless, is 2 plus 1. This model of gravity will be a good candidate to live on a world volume of a 2 plus 1 dimensional membrane, or you can study it in principle as a 2 plus 1 dimensional quantum gravity model if you want. Now, in d dimensions, these spatial dimensions will have the appropriate number of polarizations of the graviton. In particular, if you take this theory as an effective theory in 3 plus 1, of course, kappa squared would be of dimension length or something. So this is not power counting the normalizer, but it's an effective theory, just like Einstein's GR. But I can look at the spectrum near flat space. The flat space is the solution. And you get two transverse traceless polarizations of the graviton, plus a scalar polarization, which is essentially the volume element of the spatial metric. And they all have a dispersion relation which exhibits the z equal to 2 scaling. Now, as I mentioned, the equal balance condition that I imposed on the previous transparency, you can view it in two different ways. You can say it's a technical trick. So if I return to the previous transparency, instead of writing here an arbitrary combination of all terms that have r squared in it, and if your dimension is greater than greater than 2 plus 1, then these terms, there will be many different terms that you can write down. So instead of writing the generic action, I constrain it to be of this form. So it's a technical trick how to cut down on the number of independent couplings. Maybe I can more easily calculate beta functions if I have, let's say, two classically marginal couplings instead of when I have 8 of them.
Is there an implicit assumption that GRJ is invertible?
I'm assuming GRJ is an invertible metric.
That isn't.
Well, whether or not that represents a technical difficulty, that hasn't showed up yet because we haven't done hard enough quantum calculations to see that's an issue. It could be also an issue in the commutation relations, because if you want to postulate the commutation relation between the metric and the momentum, then if the metric is supposed to be positive, definitely there is a tension there. You may want to resolve that. This has been discussed, of course. This is the same issue that was discussed in the fast integral quantization of GR in the metric variables also. You can try to switch to field bind variables. You can try to start allowing singular configurations of the field bind and so on. But that's going to be relevant when we actually sit down and do calculations in one version of the theory or another. Here, we're basically still probing the set of solutions, the set of theories with various gauge symmetries and various field configurations.
Just a question.
Sure.
In your option number 3, you seem to give a provincial to the Langevin equation.
The Langevin equation is essentially the Ricci flow equation here. And that makes the theory interesting for other reasons also, not just as a physical theory, but there's a lot of contact with the Perelman theory of Ricci flows in the mathematical context of proving the Poincaré conjecture. So the connection with the Langevin equation is really very deep here, and we haven't really probed the implications yet. So for the time being, I'm saying, for practical reasons, I'm more on the side where I'm saying, for now, it's a technical trick, but it might be very interesting to probe the physics of that.
One more question?
Sure.
You say it in point one that it reduces the number of couplings. Could you just expand on that a little
bit? That's a conjecture. But, there's a, of course, again, where to begin? This hasn't been really properly explored in the gravitational setting, but if you look at non-gravitational field theories, for example, if you try to do the stochastic quantization of four-dimensional angles, you end up constructing a very similar framework like here. And there, it has been proven that the number of independent couplings in the 4 plus 1 dimensional theory, where the Langevin time, the stochastic quantization time, is an extra dimensional space time, the number of couplings is the same as in Yang-Mills. In fact, the beta functions are the same for the Yang-Mills coupling constant as in 4 dimensions. And you only have to perform one additional renormalization, which is essentially telling you what the relation is between this auxiliary time of stochastic quantization and the space dimensions of the four-dimensional Euclidean theory. So in non-gravitational theories, this approach to stochastic quantization has been analyzed in detail, and the proofs are, I think, that they can be found, for example, in Nietzsche.
Also, it's not only just quantization, it's
even
STC.
Absolutely. Yeah, this can all be, in principle, rewritten by integrating in a bunch of fermions in the BRST supersymmetry form. And then that's the symmetry that actually tells you that you don't get a proliferation of couplings in the higher dimension theory. But again, I should say this has not been properly analyzed at the level of gravity theory, so at this point it's just a conjecture. We know many examples systematically, scalar field theories, gauge theories, and so on, where it worked in the context of stochastic quantization. And the construction here is essentially repeating the same steps. Okay, so let me move on to, this is something I was just mentioning, that there does seem to be a deep story relating various versions of this model to the Ricci flow equations. In particular, the easiest thing you can do is to, in principle, is to formulate a topological version of the topological Gerstle symmetry of this type of gravity model, which would localize you to the solutions of this essentially Langevin equation, or the Ricci flow equation for the metric, as it depends on space and time. So this is a spatial metric. The flow of the metric with respect to the physical time is set by some combination of curvature terms up to a spatial diffeomorphism. So again, this is a covariantized version of the Ricci flow. This, in some sense, underlies the entire formulation of the Lipschitz-type gravity with detailed balance. That doesn't necessarily mean that other versions of Lipschitz gravity where you abandon the condition of detailed balance have anything to do with the theory of Ricci flows, but the theory of Ricci flows at the mathematical level is connected. So in principle, a topological version of this gravity theory with detailed balance would be a quantum field theory of the Ricci flows. And in principle, you can start defining correlation functions of physical observables defined as usual in the same cohomological sense as in Witten's topological field theories. And in principle, that gives you a new set of mathematically potentially interesting observables, which may or may not be relevant for the mathematical theory of Ricci flows. Again, stressing the point that trying to get conventional general relativity in 3 plus 1 in the infrared of this theory is not necessarily the only possible motivation for why this is an interesting set of theories. Mathematical applications are in there. I'm tempted to skip the case of the critical dimension here, because this is somewhat tangential to the main interest, perhaps, of this audience. But just very briefly, if you look at z equal to 2 gravity, as I showed you in power counting, the theory is that it's critical dimension in 2 plus 1, which is, of course, not a coincidence. And it happens to be the same dimension where the Lipschitz scalar theory is at its critical dimension. So you can try to couple those two together and study this as a possible theory on the work volume of the membrane. And that's an interesting problem, which has its own interesting features. The most interesting universal lesson here is that in order to establish a contact between this anisotropic 2 plus 1 dimensional theory and the conventional Polyakov 2 dimensional relativistic path integral, you need to match, in some sense, the gauge symmetries of the Polyakov integral. If you're in the critical dimension, you want some notion of conformal invariants. And that's a very interesting story, because now it is somewhat surprising, perhaps, that you can promote the anisotropic global scalings into a local Weyl symmetry in a way which is compatible with the gauge symmetries. To me, that was a surprise at first, but it does work. If you define the space-time dependent rescalings of the spatial metric and the lapse and shift functions in this particular fashion, note the presence of z here, but not here or here, then this type of anisotropic Weyl transformation forms a closed algebra of exploration preserving diffeomorphisms. And that's very important here for establishing the possibility of having a system which is classically anisotropically Weyl invariant. Of course, we still expect quantum anomalies as usual in local scale transformations. So I'm not pretending to know anything about the quantum behavior of the system other than I expect anomalies. But classically, you can have a system which is classically invariant under these anisotropic Weyl transformations. And later on, it will be important for Charles to talk, because he's going to be talking about how these types of structures with anisotropic scaling allow you to define conformal boundary of conventional general relativistic solutions with anisotropic near infinity structure at the boundary, relevant for ADS-CFT for quantum matter systems. So long story short, let's not dwell too much on the z equal to 2 gravity in 2 dimensions. Let's go directly to z equal 3 in 3 plus 1. Z equal 3 would be the dimension which you want to, the value of z you want to pick in 3 plus 1 dimensions if you want to be power functionally normalizable. And again, many of you are familiar with the details of the story from my papers. if you insist still on the detailed balance condition or on the underlying Langevin equation connection, there is precisely one term in three dimensions, namely the Chern silence action, where gamma is a functional of the metric. If you vary this, you get the equation of motion which tells you that the Parton tensor, the measure of conformal flatness or non-flatness of a three-dimensional metric, should follow from the variation of the action. So you can just take this Parton-York tensor, or as I've been reminded by D of ADM, should be properly called the ADM Parton-York tensor because it already appeared in the ADM paper in 1963 or so. So if you take this tensor and square it, that's your candidate piece in the potential term of the action. So that would be, in short, a starting point for how you want to discuss the theory in 3 plus 1 dimensions. Now, the important thing of relevant affirmations. If I start with 3 plus 1 dimensional z equal to 3 theory, which is dominated by this Parton tensor squared term in the action, I turn on the most relevant affirmations that I have. There are two. I can turn on the three-dimensional Einstein term and the cosmological constant term in three dimensions. I run it through the machinery of the detailed balance construction, and what comes out is an action which accidentally, again, in the same RG sense as usual, so in the technical sense, it accidentally has leading terms which are precisely the spatial scalar curvature and a cosmological constant term. Those are exactly the terms that you get in the ADM decomposition of the conventional general relativity. So before you claim victory and say this does reproduce conventional GR, there are of course several discrepancies between this naive affirmation and the conventional GR in the infrared. First of all, we did say in the minimal model that the lattice function is only a function of time. As a result, this theory will have an extrapolarization at least if you expand it in flat space, and that may or may not be a solution. That's a very important point. One may or may not be a ground state, to be precise. Also, we had the coupling constant lambda, which is locked to be equal to 1 in GR, but here it's an arbitrary coupling in principle, so it wants to run and should be calculated in principle how it runs. And of course, the gauge symmetries are smaller, at least in this minimal model, because we have only foliation preserving the geomorphisms. So, again, there is a lot of interesting overlap with the work of Ambion, Yurkevich, Lowell, and their additional collaborators. And perhaps we can discuss this in more detail during the conference. And I'm looking forward to Jan's talk later this afternoon. I'm just reminding you that the reason why their numerical simulations actually work is that they do put in some extra structure into their spacetime at the microscopic lattice scale. They say that the spacetime has to conform to a preferred foliation by time slices. Of course, the technical procedure is done in imaginary time, and so the imaginary time manifold, it has a preferred structure of a foliation, and only then, by putting this structure in by hand, they get a really beautiful continuum limit, or what appears to be a continuum four-dimensional limit. And the famous result, again being, I'm still quoting the numbers from the old papers, so perhaps the numbers are slightly different now. In any case, the effective spectral dimension is famously 4 and reduces to roughly 2 at short distances. And this is precisely the behavior. At first, you might speculate, you could say perhaps this reduction down to 2 is effectively because of some foam structure at short distances. But there is an alternative continuum explanation in the framework of gravity models with anisotropic scaling. You can, again, define the spectral dimension the same geometric way that they do, namely by putting an auxiliary diffusion process on your spacetime and calculating the return probability leading off the dimension that's effectively seen by the process. And here, if you put the appropriate anisotropic diffusion process on your smooth, flat, Minkowski-like solution, calculate the spectral dimension, this is what comes out. So if you have three spatial dimensions, V is equal to 3, and the theory flows from z equal to 3 in the UV to z equal to 1 in the infrared, there's a crossover that takes you from an effective spectral dimension close to 2 at short distances to close you to 4 at long distances. So it's exactly the same qualitative behavior. And as I argued when I was mentioning the Lipschitz-type phase diagram, we do have precisely two relevant affirmations here. So again, there's going to be a two-dimensional phase diagram with the Lipschitz point being a tracritical point and three different phases connected. This looks awfully similar to what Jan and Renata were showing us in their talks. So more on that, I'm sure, will come later. You can play additional games. You can say y stop is equal to 3. Maybe I can have z equal to 4 in 4 plus 1 dimensions. Maybe that's relevant for ideas CFD if you want to end up with a 4-dimensional field theory dual to a gravity system. And there the really nice thing is that if the randomization group properties of the theory in 4 plus 1 are inherited from the randomization group properties of the four-dimensional Euclidean action. The four-dimensional Euclidean action that you need to construct z equal to 4 is precisely the asymptotically free R-squared type theory of gravity in four Euclidean dimensions. So in some sense, you can take advantage of the asymptotic freedom of this type of theory without having to deal with the ghosts that would come from trying to recrotate this back to 3 plus 1 dimensions. Here, the recrotation is irrelevant. You start with four-dimensional Euclidean higher derivative gravity and use it as a seed to form a 4 plus 1 dimensional theory, which would be conjecturally asymptotically free if the same proofs extend again that work for stochastic quantization of, let's say, Yang Mills, if they extend to gravity. I'm almost out of time, so I won't spend any time on the applications to ADS-CFT, but I want to mention one other example of a theory which has an isotropic Lipschitz-type structure, and it has actually been known for decades. In the literature, it's known as the ultra-local theory of gravity. And it's a theory which, in some sense, you can think of it as either taking the z goes to zero, or perhaps more interestingly, z goes to infinity limit. But in the potential term, instead of having so many spatial derivatives, you just throw away everything and keep only the cosmological constant term. This was proposed first by Aishim and other people after him as a possible strongly coupled starting point for a new expansion in quantum gravity. Never quite worked that way. And this is not why I'm interested in the theory. I'm interested in it for the following reason. This is a beautiful example of a system which appears by design. You would say, I'm throwing away the spatial curvature part of the metric of the Einstein-Hilbert action. I've surely violated the gate symmetry of Einstein-Hilbert. And that's true, except strangely, this theory ends up having the same number of local gate symmetries as general relativity. And the way it works is that you get still a foliation by Clifford time slices. You get 3 reparametrizations of space, but you get a fourth gauge symmetry, which behaves as a U1 local gauge symmetry. And essentially, you can trace it back to the abelianization of the time reparametrizations of space-time. So this is a theory which has a foliation, but has the same number of local gauge symmetries as GR. And if I had more time, and we do have more time for the discussion, that is, over the next couple of days, so perhaps this can come up in discussions, you can ask, is it possible to mimic this in some more interesting case, not just the ultra-local theory, but a theory which has a really good kind of fixed point structure, and you have a nice Gaussian fixed point that you can use as a starting point for calculations? In other words, can you produce a theory which has an isotropic scaling, but it has general covariance in the same sense as the ultra-local theory, namely the same number of local gauge symmetries as GR, even though the algebra is perhaps deformed? So since I'm out of time, I would like to mention at least 2 such constructions very briefly. One of them is, if you actually keep the subleading term in the expansion of the 0-0 component of the metric, which I'll call A0, as I'm taking the non-relativistic limit in some sense of GR, the foliation and the homomorphisms would be the symmetries that preserve this particular splitting of the metric, but I can keep the subleading mu field, which is essentially just a one-component field. If I postulate this type of gauge symmetry, roughly speaking, for it, A0 transforms as a time component of a vector, and the shift variables transform as a spatial component of a gauge field, then this will be a gauge symmetry of a system which will first of all fix the coupling constant lambda to be equal to 1. It will require an additional coupling. And as it turns out, the simplest way of making the theory generally covariant in the sense of having this extra U1 gate symmetry, turns out it works in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So we can discuss in detail why. And now, luckily, Charles will talk about his entire next part of my transparencies on Tuesday, so I can completely skip over it. I'll just dump all the responsibilities explaining it on him. And I want to mention the second possibility of how we can make sense, perhaps, of a theory which has general covariance. And it actually brings me back to the idea of an isotropic. This is still Charles. This is not Charles anymore. This is Charles and Kevin Rosbener, another student at Berkeley. So this is a paper in preparation. We can motivate the construction by taking a horizon scalar of the Schwarzschild metric, but the details are not that important. The details lead to the following suggestion. Instead of splitting space-time into time and space, split it into one time and one space dimension. Let's call them x alpha, plus the rest of space. And it can be in four dimensions, so theta and rho would be roughly the coordinates on the horizon of a Schwarzschild black hole. It can be in any dimension. And postulate an RG scaling, which is anisotropic in this following sense. X alpha scale relativistically, but YA, all the remaining dimensions, scale with z going to infinity. This is, by the way, another way of obtaining an effective spectral dimension d spectral equal to 2 at short distances. This is the short distance description of the theory. This is motivated by Fermi clip behaviors, and I'm happy to discuss this in private or in discussions. And long story short, again, this leads to a theory of anisotropic gravity, where the action is, roughly speaking, you take the four-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert action and subtract from it the part that essentially corresponds to the two-dimensional scalar curvature. This is going to be, again, anisotropic. Now, the anisotropy is in between various spatial dimensions. But this is power counting, renormalizable in any dimension, just like the Fermi liquid fixed point is this power counting, renormalizable theory in any space-time dimension. So, future directions are many. I'm listing some of them here. And I thank you for your attention.
I'm going to take questions one second. Where's our next speaker, Paul? Do you want to come to the front and set up? Because we're running a little bit.
Should just be on that, yeah.
Okay. So,
me?
You.
Okay. So for the simplest example of the of the Lipschitz fixed point for the scalar theory which you mentioned, so for an interacting theory, you would expect to get a speed of light which is scale dependent because of renormalization.
Well, certainly there are corrections to the relativistic behavior. One way of seeing them would be to say maybe the speed of light has a dependence on the scale. But of course, the theory is at the fundamental scale, it has nothing to do with Lorentz invariants.
I understand. So, how would you interpret this in the infrared? Like, if, it's like having a d phi whole square term, and that coefficient will be renormalized due to coupling effect.
Well, you can insist that you'll phrase everything in terms of relativistic variables because you have, as a low energy observer, you might have the prejudice that the physics should be Lorentz invariant, and then you start seeing higher terms that violate Lorentz invariance in the effective action. You'll have higher derivative corrections.
Okay.
And there's probably an alternative way of rephrasing that in terms of correcting the speed of light, but that's not what the low energy observer wants to do because of the prejudice of the Lorentz invariant environment.
In your last subject about the Fermi liquid theory, will it support the idea that the fundamental fields in this theory could be Fermi-like?
Oh, that's
because of the Fermi C effect.
That's a beautiful idea in principle, but I have no way of making the connection. I'm just taking the formal analogy here, saying that we've learned beautiful lessons from the RG theory of Fermi liquids, and some of them actually find applications in the theory where the path integral is defined in terms of the metric variables. Mm-hmm. And I'm basically also saying the crucial difference between the normalization of a relativistic fermionic system and the Fermi liquid is that you're zooming in on the correct ground state, which is the Fermi surface. And here, we are basically saying, what if we don't zoom in on the origin, the momentum space, but we zoom in onto the horizon of the black hole, to get an isotropic scaling, and essentially, just like the Fermi liquid, the first approximation is a collection of 1 plus 1 dimensional fermion theories parametrized by the location on the Fermi surface. Here you get a collection of 1 plus 1 gravities parametrized by where you are on the horizon of the black hole. It's a formal analogy. I don't know how to. It would be beautiful if you can, let's say, rewrite one
theory in terms of the other, but that's just
Fermi systems are much more stable, they're not as common.
Sure, and there are very many hints that in holography somehow there should be some fermionic structure for this system.
One last question, Sophie.
I was wondering, because you were saying that you were suggesting that Lipschitz gravity should be the fundamental theory behind it, should be string theory. But you're also saying at the same time that Lorentz symmetry should not be a fundamental symmetry then. But if you write down your string action, right, there is no anisotropic scaling in that, which would somehow relate.
If you write down the action in Minkowski space and you insist on Lorentz invariance, you can do that. But we probably don't know how much ignorance we have about consistent solutions in string theory. And I would be very surprised if there were not many unknown solutions in string theory which have nothing to do with relativistic invariance. In fact, I think some of them have already been constructed by various people. Jalma, for example, has very interesting models which don't particularly seem to be attached to the idea of Lorentz symmetry, and they seem to be consistent backgrounds in string theory. I'm not sure that they are of the type that people really wanted to say there is a system which is really Lorentz invariant, the Lorentz, and as we calculate corrections, we see that it becomes non-Lorentz invariant at short distances, but it's at least a start. And so we should definitely be exploring string theory outside of the classes backgrounds that we focused on so far. And those were mostly relativistic, but that's for historical reasons, in my opinion.
Okay, I'm sure there are lots of questions, but we've got 3 days and we have to keep moving along. So let's thank Petter again.